We're going to do this a little bit different today. I'm going to pass out these sheets of paper, and each of you can take one. Just pass it along. Man comes bearing gifts. Maybe you better take some more towards the back. You don't have to read. Don't worry about it. Yes. Does everyone have one now?
No.
They're coming along. They're coming there, I think. Need some more in the back corner there? Yours coming also? How are we doing? In the back. We're okay? Okay, so there are this is actually originally was a poem. But to translate the meter and the rhyme and the poetry from Pali into English was too difficult for me to do. So it's been translated more or less into prose. And there's 20 verses, I think. That's right. 20 verses. And now this comes from a collection of texts known as the Sutta Nipata. And within the Sutta Nipata, there's a number of chapters. And one of the chapters is called the Chapter of Eights. And the Chapter of Eights has something like 16 or 20 poems. And this particular Chapter of Eights is considered by scholars to be perhaps among the most ancient of the Buddhist teachings. So kind of almost like a primitive early form of Buddhist teachings before it was well formulated and systematized and lists and all that. And for this is and whatever. So it's kind of significant historically for that reason. And
does it come after the Chapter of Sevens?
No, there is no Chapter of Sevens. It's called the Chapter of Eights because the first few poems of this chapter have eight verses in them. So the chapter is a chapter that contains the eight verse poems. But this particular one is, I think, poem 16, and this one has 20 verses. So what I thought is that 20 different people who have the reading glasses could each take turns reading one of these verses. Yes.
Those who stick to their own views and argue that this alone is true obtain either blame or praise.
Obtaining praise is a trifling thing, not enough to bring tranquility. Realizing this, one should not argue, seeing the peaceful state wherein there is no argument.
The wise have nothing to do with countless opinions. Should one who is unaffiliated become affiliated, accepting what has been seen and heard from tradition?
Also consider virtuous conduct to be the highest.
say that purity comes through self-restraint. Having undertaken religious observance, they dedicate themselves to it, saying, in this alone we should train ourselves, and so attain purity. Claiming to be skillful, they remain in cyclic existence.
If they fall away from their virtuous conduct and religious observance, they tremble at having failed in their task. Such people long for purity like a lost person longs for a caravan.
But by abandoning all virtuous conduct and religious observances, as well as both blameless and blameworthy actions, and by desiring neither purity nor impurity, one dwells unattached, cultivating peace.
Relying on ascetic austerities, on fasting, or on what has been seen or heard from others, they speak of purity, but they are not free from craving for one existence after another.
Craving leads to more craving and to suffering from confused views. But how could those who are free of birth and death be confused or aberrations?
Some say that a certain teaching is the highest, while others claim it is inferior. All of them claim to be adepts. Which then is right?
They claim their own teachings are perfect, and that of others to be inferior. Thus contending, they argue, considering their own opinions to be true.
If a teaching were truly inferior just because others criticize it, then no teaching could be established as the best, since all people firmly champion their own teachings while claiming that others' teachings are contemptible.
In honoring their own teachings, they also praise their own path. If everything they say is true, then purity must be unique to them.
Those who are upright and who have investigated the various teachings rely neither on others or on views. Not seeing one doctrine as better than another, they have gone beyond dispute.
Saying I know and I see that this is just so, some claim that purity comes about through one's views, but what good is it to see if one leaves the path?
One who sees will only see and know concepts and form. Whether one has much or little insight, the adepts agree that purity does not come from views.
Dogmatists are hard to restrain, since they prefer their own preconceived views. Claiming that good is in their views, they speak of purity, they say it is inherent in their insight.
Having understood, those who are upright do not rely on imagination, views, or intellectual knowledge. Knowing the many types of opinions, they are even-minded toward them all, saying others may take them up if they wish.
Having untangled the tangle, the sage does not side with any side of the dispute. Calm among those who are calm, the sage says, others may take them up if they wish.
Having let go of their former contaminants, not creating new ones, sages do not choose sides. Avoiding dogmatism, steadfast and freed from views, they neither cling to the world nor reproach themselves.
The wise have nothing to do with doctrines based on what has been thought out or seen or heard from others. They have set down their burden and are free, neither attached nor craving for anything.
So the Buddha has spoken. in Palo Alto. I know I have I know one professor of teaches classes, Introduction to Buddhism classes, and at the end of the Introduction to Buddhism class, she gives a translation of this particular text to her students without telling them where it's from. And the assignment is to tell her whether it's a Buddhist text or not. And then they get graded on how well, not on the, whether they're right or wrong, but how well they argue their position about it, whether it's a Buddhist text or not. And it's interesting, you know, it seems like half the students say it's Buddhist text and half don't say it's not. A little bit different kind of teachings than maybe some of you are used to hearing from Buddhism or reading about. What was that like for some of you? What were some of your responses or reactions to hearing or reading this? Yes?
It's rather like the Tao Te Ching, the true Tao is not the only to be spoken of. It emphasizes that the concepts and the discussions are not really what the essence of it is.
Maybe. Yes?
Well, I immediately thought of the Tao Te Ching also, because it's Holmes and Tao Te Ching one, because I'm like, one who feels important must have felt unimportant, and vice versa. It goes into things like that, which is exactly what's said here.
Uh-huh. Yes?
It's just one of those places in the Dharma where I look and I say, oh God, I have so far to go. not having opinions about things.
Maybe the point is not so much to not have opinions as it is to not be attached to them, or not to have. What is the? So it seems very much that there's somewhat this text is somewhat against the idea of at least being at the minimum being attached to your opinions, or thinking that opinions are going to lead the way to some kind of spiritual results. What do you think, reading, having read this only once, but what do you think is, from the point of view of the text itself, it would be the best, the highest attainment that a person could attain or seek for, or want?
Non-attachment.
Non-attachment, that's one. What else? Openness?
Equanimity.
What else?
Purity?
Mm-hmm. Maybe. What else?
Freedom from doctrine.
Freedom from doctrine?
It seems like it's asking for your own personal experience.
Good.
Tolerance.
Sorry?
Tolerance.
Non-judgment.
Freedom from craving.
Good.
Compassion.
Compassion, perhaps. There's a word that I'm looking for that, I mean, all those are good, but there's a word I'm looking for that's actually in the text.
Uprightness.
That's a very interesting word, those who are upright. It kind of holds up those who are upright. What does it mean to be upright? So not necessarily being upright doesn't necessarily mean you. It's more of a character issue than it is an issue of gnosis or knowledge or understanding, isn't it?
Virtuous.
Looking for truth.
Looking for truth.
Not leaning in any direction.
Being self-reliant, maybe. Upright. What?
The Chinese character for true speech having roots in experience.
Nice. But I'm still looking for this one word that's in the text that.
Wise or wisdom?
Question everything?
I don't know. I don't know if that's the message of the text. It's kind of exhausting. To go around questioning everything. There's something else. The text says it uses this wonderful word. at least a couple of times.
Even-minded.
Okay, by abandoning all virtuous conduct and religious observances, as well as both blameless and blameworthy actions, and by desiring neither purity nor impurity, one dwells unattached, cultivating peace. To be at peace. Cultivating peace. Sorry?
Is that what upright means?
I'm not sure. Maybe. But to me, this text, one of the things, certainly the text champions the idea of not being attached and not to opinions and not using opinions to be in arguments and using opinions to kind of put down other people. But the point of it, as I read a text, one of the points for doing that is maybe not so much to question everything as it is to discover for oneself our own individual potential for being at peace, to have the heart to be at peace, to have some kind of inner peace in ourselves. And what exactly to be at peace means is for each of us to find out. But in this early tradition of Buddhism, the idea of being at peace was a very, very high ideal. And what's interesting about the early texts, if you haven't read, there's a lot more poems in this text, but one of the ways they emphasize spiritual practice is that basically the means and the goal are the same. In this way, in that the goal is to be peaceful, and the way to do that is to be peaceful, or to behave peacefully, and then peace will become an ever deepening aspect of a person's life. So it's not so much that you have to do something strategically, you know, kind of step by step to attain something in the future, but rather you act in the way that you want to become. Or, does that make sense? So the means and the goal, in a sense, are the same. I like this text a lot. One of the reasons I like it is that it speaks very directly to the problem of people holding on to views and opinions. And it points to the fact that it seems that the Buddha was rather unique in the world of the spiritual traditions in offering a spiritual practice that did not rely on a metaphysical belief system, did not rely on some kind of supernatural beliefs. And I find this quite remarkable. I don't know how many religious teachers or religious traditions in the world have actually been able to pull that off, to actually offer a religious or spiritual tradition that there was no metaphysical or supernatural beliefs that underpinned the very practice it did. I think of Krishnamurti, who certainly did that. But Krishnamurti did so thoroughly, in a sense, that he didn't offer anybody any practices either. And so I heard recently that at the very end of his life, someone asked the Krishnamurti if in his all his teaching career, if anybody had really understood him. And he said no. So I don't know if that's true, but a lot of people have understood what Krishnamurti was talking about, but had no sense or idea of how to put it into practice, how to make it alive and really relevant for themselves. And certainly Krishnamurti was critical of Buddhism, just as one other religion that was somehow leading people away from themselves. But maybe that's one of the reasons the Buddha himself was shy or reluctant to talk about a lot of metaphysical beliefs, is because he knew that beliefs have a way of taking the individual away from themselves. You can actually become a stranger to yourself by adhering to beliefs. Yes?
You translated this?
I did, yes.
Can you give us some insight as to what the Pali word then for belief is and what that implies or opinion? Is it the same word that is used repetitively?
Oh, I don't remember very well. It's been 5 years ago. But one of the common words that's being translated here as views is ditti. Ditti. which has a double meaning, like in English, of views, you know, seeing, kind of, but it means opinions, ditti. So that, I don't know if that helps. Yes?
I don't mean to digress, but what's the difference between a religion and a philosophy? It seems like what we're talking about has something to do with the definition.
Do you think Buddha was offering a philosophy? Well, in the old Greek sense of philosophy, was philosophy something you lived by? Philosophy wasn't just simply abstract ideas and thinking, you know, completely just... I mean, nowadays, some philosophers think wonderful philosophical ideas and theories, but it has no connection to how they live their lives. In ancient Greece, the philosophers of that time were passionately involved in understanding philosophy, the love of wisdom, to help them live better lives. So in that sense, maybe Buddhism is more of a philosophy than a religion, we could say. And many people have argued that. So, you know, I don't have an opinion on that matter.
It doesn't really matter.
You know, you say that this sutta was originally in verse and not in prose. Are the suttas often written in verse? Is there a particular reason why they would structure it that way? There's a
number of texts from the early tradition that are in poem, in verse. In some texts, the Buddha begins by speaking in prose, and then he recaps what he just said in verse, summarizes it, or whatever. And this early book, the Sutta Nipata, is all verse. Some texts are all prose. And one of the reasons is that it helps memorization in verse. That's maybe perhaps one reason. But I think more profoundly, remember, this was an oral culture. They didn't really have writing of any. They had writing in India at that time, but it wasn't really used for much for anything, and certainly not in these kinds of scenes. You know, the religious teachings were not committed to writing, and so the religious teachings were memorized and spoken. It was very much an oral culture. And most cultures that were very oral, people's brains were very attuned to the poetic qualities of words and using verse. And it seems that in oral cultures that people had much easier ability to speak in verse, sometimes spontaneously to express their joy and their happiness or some great emotion. They would just kind of, it would come out kind of in verse. And so sometimes there's one text called the Udana, which Udana, I think, means something like, vaguely, very roughly, means something like the Buddha's joyful explanations in verse. You know, and so the Buddha's just full of enthusiasm, for joyful, and want to express the Dharma, and he kind of comes out of him in his poetry. Isn't that beautiful? Yes?
Reading this reminds me of when I was 19, I used to hear Rajneesh use the term choicelessly aware, and it was really hard for me to understand that then. And now, through my mindfulness practice and being exposed to Thich Nhat Hanh, I'm starting to get an understanding of that. I was wondering if you could just comment, did the Buddha use that phrase a lot?
Choicelessly aware?
Yeah.
I never known him to use that word expression. It's used. That expression is used by Vipassana teachers at various times, and it seems that the origin of that particular expression, which kind of, in some sense, encapsulates some aspects of Buddhist practice very well. The origin of not choicelessly aware, which is Rajneesh's, you know, he was also brilliant with words, but it seems the origin of that expression comes from Krishnamurti, and he used the word choiceless awareness. And I suspect that Rajneesh, in his brilliance, turned the word slightly to choicelessly aware. It's a little bit slightly different meaning. Because I kind of like it. To be aware, but it's, you do it choicelessly. What a relief. Laura.
Have you thought about this at all, or applied this to what's happening right now in this country?
Well, yeah, I think one of the things, we can all apply it this way, you know, one of the things we can look at is look inside ourselves and find whatever degree of peace or calm or equanimity or at ease that we can find inside ourselves, establish it ourselves in whatever sense of calm or ease we can, and then ask ourselves, is getting angry or upset or defensive around a particular opinion or view worth the cost of losing that peace and that ease? And then you can ask another question. Is it possible for you to take care of what you need to take care of in this world? Take a position at times, if need be, or whatever, but do it in such a way that you don't lose that ease and that peace. And I think that, to me, is one of the great challenges of the Buddhist tradition, is that we all lose our peace and our ease all too easily.
It's happening so painfully.
So painfully.
Everybody taking their views, you know, and it's creating so much separation.
Exactly. That's one of the reasons why views and opinions are so dangerous. It depolarizes people, and people end up fighting, killing each other. I mean, there's been a lot of killing in this world based simply on opinions. And Washington, D.C. hasn't gotten to that point yet. But if we were only a few decades back, I suspect some of the players would have whipped out their gloves and slapped. You know, so I think wasn't there a president in the United States who did a duel? Andrew Jackson. Alan Burr also?
Alexander Hamilton.
Maybe.
Hamilton was vice president.
Yeah. Jackson did it too? So there were ways in the old days they took care of these things.
And there was one incident somewhere near the Civil War, where on, I believe, the House floor, one congressman nearly beat another one to death with his cane.
So there's opinion. So does it? So what is it to have a peaceful heart or have some kind of inner peace? Now, one of the things that this text is saying, I believe, is that maybe a little bit like Martin Luther, he's saying that your inner peace, your inner ease or equanimity or whatever, is not dependent on doing either blameworthy or blameless activity. Martin Luther said you can't, you know, good works is not going to do it. Right? It's an act of grace that you get saved. In Lutheranism, right? Something like that, right? I don't really know that well. I was only baptized as a Lutheran. That's all. But here the Buddha is saying somewhat the same thing. It's not based on whether you do things that are blameworthy or blameless. You know, even doing wholesome things is not necessarily going to lead to this inner peace. That inner peace is not dependent on doing either one. Your inner peace is not dependent on the view and opinion that you hold. Your inner peace maybe is not dependent on the kind of religious observances that you follow. So, how do you react to that? What do you think about that? Does the idea of some kind of peace, inner peace, seem interesting to you, or does it seem foreign and maybe even, you know, unattractive? Yeah.
It makes me, if cultivating inner peace is set up as the highest goal for a way to live, it makes me wonder, where is the place for passionately advocating what you also value highly? And what about people who cultivate inner peace but have a different framework, you know?
What we be very careful for is not to confuse outer expressions with inner peace. I think of the way an Italian, you know, Mediterranean person would, could have the same level of inner peace as a Norwegian. But the way that they kind of behave would look very different. It's just, kind of partly cultural conditioning, whatever. But the measure is not how we behave, but rather, are we at ease inside? And so the question is, the first question, what about passionately being engaged in some cause? I know a lot of people, and I'm sure you know also, who have been engaged passionately in very wholesome causes, even causes of ending war, and have been very angry in the process. So, is it possible to be in opposition to something, for example, to war, and do that with a peaceful heart, and do that with great, maybe passion? I think of one of the most passionate people on the planet in this century was Mahatma Gandhi. But I also think, when I think about him, I also think of someone who kept his inner peace really close at hand. And he was able to do phenomenal things. And passionately, very passionately, untiringly.
I sometimes wonder how much real inner peace there was in Gandhi's inner inside,
Yeah, we don't know. I don't know. Yes?
I just want to say that I feel really open to the idea of peace, but sometimes I think there's a temptation for us to take peace into our lives at the cost of sensitivity. We accept peace into our lives while shutting out the needs and sorrows and sicknesses and problems of the world, and we call that sense of inner dullness our peace. And I just want to say I want to
Beautiful.
Be aware of that.
Very much. So in the Buddhist tradition, there's warnings not to confuse peace or equanimity with indifference. And that's phenomenally dangerous. And it's called the near enemy of peace. Because near enemy is something which looks like it, but is really, the opposite spectrum. And one of the tendencies in the Buddhist tradition is actually not so often to define the goal of the spiritual life, like, for example, to say specifically peace, but rather in a positive definition, but rather to use a negative one because of that danger. So rather than saying you're supposed to be peaceful, it says, like in the very last verse, it says, neither attached nor craving for anything. And when you're in a state of neither attached nor craving, just let yourself be that way. Don't worry about what it is. You'd probably be at peace. But as soon as we name it positively, then sometimes people get attached to it in an unhealthy way. Yes, someone else? Yeah, Lelaine.
What role does the Eightfold Noble Path of Right Views and Right Actions play when the inner peace doesn't depend on those things?
Why do you say it doesn't depend on them?
Well, I thought you said that inner peace doesn't depend on blameworthy or unblameworthy conduct. And I understand that to mean that when inner peace doesn't depend on your observing, the rules of the virtues.
I think rather than saying it doesn't depend on it, or depends on it, I would say that the Eightfold Path supports it. But not necessarily so. I mean, someone can be engaged. I know people who've been engaged in elements of the Eightfold Path, and it's made them more in conflict with themselves. So, for example, people who do meditation practice or concentration practice, and so they have some ability to get concentrated, but they're measuring themselves against some higher standard, and then they feel unworthy because they haven't attained some higher standard, and so they feel worse about themselves. Or one of the Eightfold Paths is right livelihood. Having a right livelihood is supportive of being peaceful, but you can also have right livelihood and be attached to it and be dependent on it, thinking that the way you behave is all that you need to do to be kind of virtuous. And to be virtuous is the way to be. So you can be confused in doing the Eightfold Path if you have misunderstand its application. And that's why the Eightfold Path begins with right view, right understanding. And I think it's really important to see that. And right understanding is based on the Four Noble Truths. which is based on the idea of understanding the difference between an inner life which is conflicted and an inner life which is at peace. To see when they're suffering and to see the cause of that suffering. If you can really see that and then really apply that understanding of the cause of suffering to everything you do, you understand how to do things peacefully. I hope. Yes?
Is the ideal of, is the wrong word, of peace, how does that relate to being awake?
That's a good point. That's a good question. Perhaps they're synonymous. Or maybe not literally synonymous exactly, but when a person is fully awakened, that person is also fully at peace. When a person is fully at peace, they're also fully awakened.
I know for myself, when I wake up in a situation and find myself pulled in various directions, that the awareness supports letting go of that and toward the direction of peace.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Yes?
I wonder if you could say a few more words about how one can differentiate between peace and indifference. I mean, that's kind of a doubt in my mind.
It's a very good one to be concerned about. And I think the ladies back there who brought up the issue kind of described it well. Part, in one way to understand, is if there's a lack of sensitivity to the world around you, then I think it's indifference. And I think actually, if a person is paying careful attention, I think that there actually be a subtle form of aversion when there's a kind of numbness to what's going on around one. If the peace is really open, I don't think there'll be any there won't be any aversion. There'll just be open sensitivity to what's happening. Yeah.
I think
that's an important point. So sensitivity leads to action. That I hope, because Buddhist life is not supposed to be one that's vegetable, not taking responsibility for the world we live in. So sensitivity leads to action, but our lives are fairly complicated. If we were acting locally, if we're acting just really close at hand, our neighbor is sick, so we go shopping for them. It doesn't really take a lot of views and opinions to do that. It just, we act properly. But in a complex society as we are, and we start looking beyond just, the local situation, then we enter into what's called politics, right? And so the question is, how do we engage in politics in a wise way? Some people choose not to be involved in politics and choose to do all their actions locally. And this is one position that has been taken within the history of Buddhism, is act locally, not politically. So when someone needs your help, offer them your help directly, but don't get involved in policy issues about how that affects generalizes about a lot of people. But there are some people, but that doesn't really feel very satisfying for many of us when we're in a democracy where there's real consequences in voting or not voting or sharing in the political process. So the question is, that requires then, does it require opinion? And then does it involve conflict with other opinions? Maybe sometimes it does, but I think for me personally, one of the challenges is to try to understand a situation well enough that that the various points of view melt away from each other, or melt together. I've seen situations where I've been polarized with someone, and because of the commitment to hang in there and discuss it long enough, we actually come to some kind of mutual understanding, where sometimes like a synthesis, where you realize you didn't have to be in conflict to begin with. because there's some common ground that can solve the problem. But, you know, and then you have questions like abortion, which, you know, can you find common ground for that? So I don't know what happens then when people get involved in such political issues. I think that's an individual choice whether we do that or not. What I'm interested in, especially in the role that I'm sitting up here, it's in the middle of all of you, what I'm interested in is do you have to lose your inner peace, your well-being, your ease, because of the opinion that you take on? Maybe you feel like you have to take an opinion, you have to act on it in a certain way, and actually, but you have to be in conflict with the world around you in such a way that you're angry or aggressive or hostile or afraid or, you know, self-righteous or condemning someone, saying they're bad because of their opinion they have that's different than your own. Can we hold an opinion and leave ourselves in this sensitive, open, peaceful way while we do it? And for me, that's the challenge, and that's what interests me the most, not whether someone picks up an opinion or not. Melissa?
I've been seeing how holding opinions causes pain for me personally, and it causes me to behave towards others badly, you know, perhaps causing suffering for them. And what I've been becoming aware of is that I need a strong dose of humility, because for these particular opinions I'm thinking of, I really do think I'm right. and yet I see that it's causing me suffering to go around thinking how right I am and to try to manipulate the other person into doing what I want to do. And for me, I think, and I don't mean humiliation, I mean humility in the sense of that I could be wrong. I know I'm right, that I could be wrong. The way I try to practice it is by saying, I'm actually thinking of a disagreement I have with my parents. And I'm trying to practice, you know, the idea that I can love and respect them and disagree. And so I'm saying all this to get to, it makes me think that one way to participate in politics and have opinions is to also practice loving kindness for people who disagree with.
There was, I told this story here, but maybe it's been many years ago. I used to live in the San Francisco Zen Center. And the Zen Center in San Francisco lived just a block away from a lot of the San Francisco projects, and a lot of poor people lived. And around the project, there were some tenements or some apartment buildings where there were some pretty avaricious landlords who took advantage of their tenants, these poor tenants. Now, being in the middle of that kind of community, the Zen Center opened a neighborhood foundation to try. Anyway, that's not the point. The point I want to say is, the Zen Center opened up a neighborhood foundation to help, try to be of service to that community. And they did tutoring and they did all kinds of stuff and try to help the community. But at some point, the question arose, should the Zen Center get involved in the conflict between the tenants and their landlords? And which meant to actually be in conflict with someone rather than just helping someone out. And I'm not saying this is the right decision, but I think it was a very interesting decision that Zen Center made. They decided not to be involved in those disputes, because if they were involved in those disputes, then the landlords wouldn't feel comfortable coming to do meditation at the Zen Center. Not that they ever came. But it wouldn't be comfortable to come to the Zen Center to meditate. And they should feel as free to come and participate in the spiritual practice as anybody else. And so there's a place where the Zen Center felt that as an institution, they should stay neutral and not get involved in conflict like that, because there's a greater good that's being served. Now, you know, it certainly can, you know, if the landlords are actually, you know, if it got really ugly, I think any, you know, sensible person would then get involved, but maybe it wasn't bad enough. Yes?
I guess just hearing all this, it makes me think that I feel like there are certain things that are wrong, and that I don't necessarily know how to go with it. You know, really physically hurting another person or doing harm. And that's wrong. I think
Well, I think so. I think that the Buddha is not saying I think that if we're sensitive, and the person next to you starts hitting over the head the person next to her, you know, you would feel that this was wrong. This was causing harm, that you wanted to see it stopped. And that would be a sensible thing to do. And I don't think that involves an opinion. Exactly. It just... Well, I don't know where the semantics is, but it doesn't seem to me that's a decision. That's not an opinion. You see someone being hurt, and I don't know if it's an opinion that says that the heartfelt movement at that point is let's try to stop this. The classic, you know, the child runs out into the car, on the street, and there's a car coming on. We kind of run out there to stop it before we question whether it's right or wrong to stop, you know, to grab the kid. If we see some kind of violence being perpetrated, some of us, before we would even ask us with a philosophical question what's right and wrong, we would act to take care of the situation. You know, if you put your hand on the stove, you don't ask whether that's good or bad before you move your hand. I think when it's that local and we're that much closely involved, I don't think it involves an opinion so much. It just kind of direct sensitivity and response to the situation. But right and wrong, even if you hold opinions of right and wrong, can you hold in such a way, and even act on them in such a way, that your sense of inner ease or peace is not... The Buddha, I think, is not to stop having opinions, but the real challenge is not to find that place in the heart or in the mind or wherever that doesn't have to either be attached or pushing away or hostile to anything. So people are pouring out the door. So either it means we should stop, or it means that we have such a comfortable scene that people just leave when they want to, and everybody else kind of stays. We talk until midnight. So again, let me one simple statement that. I hope you take a little bit as a challenge. And mostly what I hope is today's kind of discussion and this text is a little bit challenging to some of your ideas. But one of the simple things I want to say is, repeating myself, is that my understanding of what the Buddha in the Pali text was offering, the radical thing he was offering, was a spiritual practice that led to phenomenal possibility of peace, of well-being, of compassion, of open-heartedness, of being at home in the world, that was not dependent on opinions, metaphysical beliefs, supernatural understandings. So if that's the case, what role does your metaphysical beliefs and your supernatural beliefs have in your spiritual life? And I don't have an opinion about what it should be or not, but I'm very interested in when you do that investigation to see what the connection is between your inner peace and the way in which you hold your beliefs. Does that make sense? So I hope this was all interesting. In any case, you got a historical lesson. Thank you.
I have a copy of the sheet for Allison.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I'll put it in the sheet.